This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, Max Creek is a jam band made up of members Scott Murawski, Mark Mercier, John Ryder, Bill Carbone, and Jay Stanley. This year marks their, wait for it, 44th anniversary as a band. To celebrate, they joined us live in our Studio 3 to share some music that's brought them together for nearly 4.5 decades. Hope you can stick around for that. But first, it's been 1 week since Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's controversial speech before the Congress. His appearance came less than a month before the Obama administration is scheduled to complete a draft deal on Iran's nuclear programs, and just 2 weeks before Election Day in Israel. Right now, it's Republicans who are making international headlines. This week, 47 GOP senators signed a letter to Iranian leaders warning against a nuclear agreement with the U.S. With us now is Senator Chris Murphy to weigh in on some of the latest news coming out of the U.S. and the Middle East. Chris Murphy, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, you took part in a committee hearing this week on President Obama's request for authorization for use of force against ISIS. You heard from different members of the administration, including the Secretary of the State. After that hearing, where do you stand on the president's request to fight ISIS in this way?
I'm generally supportive of the strategy that the president is employing. You know, they have an Iraq first strategy by which they are going to try to push ISIS effectively out of Iraq. That will complicate matters in Syria, no doubt, but this becomes a much more manageable problem if you have ISIS on the run as it gets pushed out of Iraq. I'm also very supportive of the commitment that he's made that he's going to make our Arab partners work with our Arab partners to have them be the strength on the ground. They're really is no good things that happen from having a large number of American troops on the ground, a repeat of the mistake that we made in the Iraq War. The problem is squaring what his intended strategy is with the language that he sent Congress for authorization. To me, it is far too open-ended in its ability for this president or the next president to commit ground troops to this fight. It has a limitation, but the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State in this hearing yesterday said that the limitation basically just assures that you can't have an Iraq war style or size deployment. So if all you're saying is that you can't have 100,000 troops, but you can have 50,000 troops, that's not much of a restriction at all. So it's going to have to get tighter for me to support it, because I just don't think there's anything about the last 10 years that's an advertisement for Congress to allow for another massive troop deployment back into the Middle East to fight an enemy.
Of course, one of the issues hanging over all this is that as you debate this request from the president to use this military force, we, of course, are already using military force in the region. How much does congressional approval of this really matter, Senator?
Well, it certainly doesn't matter in practically when you have a president that claims authority under a different statute. Now, the president says that the old 2001 authorization of military force passed after the New York and Pentagon attacks gives him the ability to fight ISIS. Now, I fundamentally disagree with him. A lot of members of Congress fundamentally disagree with him. But practically, he's saying he's going to move ahead with this strategy whether he has authorization from Congress or not. I'm pretty disturbed by that. But it is right to suggest that whether we pass this or not, the president seems like he's pretty determined to go ahead. If we don't pass something simply because we think the president's going to do it anyway, you know, that really has far-reaching long-term implications for Congress's role on foreign affairs. It really would just allow the president to basically do whatever he wants anywhere in the world from here on out.
What do you think that role should be? Explain a little bit better your view of what role Congress, specifically the Senate, should play in allowing the president to deploy troops overseas.
Well, so Congress has the explicit authority and responsibility to declare war. We have not declared war against ISIL. We declared war against Al-Qaeda, but ISIL is very different than Al-Qaeda. In fact, it has frankly disavowed any association with Al-Qaeda. And so it is important for us to declare a new war against this terrorist group, which presents a threat to the United States. It is also within our authority to make sure that the strategy that we employ is the right strategy. So time and time again in the authorizations that Congress has passed, there have been restrictions, restrictions on time, restrictions on tactics, restrictions on geography. And so it's perfectly appropriate for us to say, listen, this authorization is going to last 3 years so that we get to reassess whether this is working. This restriction, this war has to be limited to just Iraq and Syria so that it doesn't spill over all across the globe like the global war on terror did, and that we should use tactics that we know work. We know that massive of deployment of ground troops in the Middle East, American ground troops, doesn't work. So let's not use that particular strategy. That's, I think, completely within the power of the Congress to do. But the bottom line is that it's not just within our power to declare war. War can't happen without Congress actually saying so. And we've got to get back to exercising that basic constitutional responsibility.
We're talking with U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, who joins us from Washington on the phone today. And this is Where We Live. We're going to move to Iran in just a moment, but it does get to this question of how much information Congress really has at its disposal to help make decisions. Could you give us a little sense of how much you feel you and your colleagues are briefed with the necessary information, the same information that the executive branch has when actually making decisions about votes, about whether to send troops in or support some sort of force to fight ISIL or to fight in Syria or to fight anywhere overseas?
Well, this is a challenge for a number of reasons. The first is that, you know, members of Congress only have a portion of their brain to spend on foreign policy. We've got to be thinking about education and healthcare and transportation and housing. So there's a limited amount of time that we can spend thinking about these problems, whereby people that work for the Department of State and the White House and the Department of Defense get to spend their entire life thinking about this. The second one, though, is something that we can do something about. Right now, so much of the activity that happens in terms of American foreign affairs is covert. Secret. And there's only a handful of members of Congress that get read into that activity, members of the Intelligence Committee. So, for instance, we've been training Syrian rebels through covert programs. That's not anything I'm divulging. It's been reported. But because I'm not a member of the Intelligence Committee, I actually can't be told how well that's going. So I can't use that information to make an assessment on whether or not we should be doing it in an overt manner, which the president has decided to do. So there are some handcuffs that I frankly think have become a little bit too onerous that restrain Congress. The bottom line is that, you know, as a member of the Foreign Relations Committee, I take my job seriously. I've traveled around the world to the region to visit our partners in Europe so that I can be as knowledgeable as possible when I make these decisions. You know, with those limitations, some of them inevitable, some of them not, I certainly don't feel like I'm underinformed.
Does the president's, in your mind, does the president's Iraq first strategy take our eyes off of the ongoing and very complex situation in Syria too much?
I just think we have to understand the limits of American power, and the civil war inside Syria is messy with bad guys on both sides. And so I have been very reluctant, as you know, to commit U.S. military resources to that civil war, because if you take the side against Assad, you're essentially, you know, doing battle alongside al-Qaeda or ISIS. But if you want to fight ISIS and al-Qaeda, then you're sitting and standing next to a vicious murderer in Bashar al-Assad. So I think that once we move ISIS out of Iraq, we're going to likely have to rely on other partners, airstrikes, tactical special operations, in order to continue to degrade ISIS inside Syria.
So meanwhile, alongside all this, the U.S., of course, is in negotiations with Iran over their nuclear program, which is opposed by Israel. But you have Republicans in the Senate writing a letter to Iran about the negotiations that the Democratic president is engaged in. What is your take on their decision to get involved in foreign policy in this way?
Well, I haven't been in Congress that long, but I've never seen anything like it. I mean, this letter is virtually unprecedented. There's no doubt that part of our job is to weigh in on foreign policy, and part of what I do every day is speak to foreign leaders. So there's nothing wrong with having a conversation with a foreign leader. But for virtually the entire Republican caucus to send a letter to the Ayatollah telling him that he shouldn't trust the President of the United States, notwithstanding the details of the negotiation, is really crossing a line, in my opinion. We don't know what this deal is going to look like. And so they actually weren't weighing in on the details of the agreement. They were just saying, don't do a deal with this president because you shouldn't trust him. And that is a level of undermining an executive that I don't think we've seen in a long time here. I really wish they hadn't done it. And quite frankly, a lot of them are saying probably and privately right now that they wish they hadn't done it now that they've seen the fallout from it.
Well, I know that you've been working closely with Senator McCain from Arizona, who was with you in the state not so long ago talking about Ukraine. Have you spoken with Senator McCain, who's been your ally on some issues in Europe, about his decision to sign on to this letter?
I haven't spoken to him. That letter was released that morning, right as we were leaving our last event that he joined
I'm
me
really
with.
Sorry I missed that event because of that. But anyway, please continue.
Yeah, it would have been much more interesting had we brought up questions about that letter. But he's been public in his assessment that the signers of that letter really hadn't given a lot of thought to it, enough thought. And I think, you know, if you read into what he said, he's one of those that I think would probably rethink it if he had known what the ramifications of it were going to be.
But between that and then Benjamin Netanyahu's speaking in front of Congress, I guess I'm wondering how you feel the United States political system right now seems to be at odds with the United States as a country and its attempts to negotiate with Iran over nuclear weapons and actually just negotiate with Iran into maybe coming into the fold of nations. It seems as though the same dysfunction that we have in Washington on a daily basis that you and I have talked about for years, Chris Murphy, is now making its way into foreign policy in a way that I don't know if I've seen before. I don't know how it strikes you in terms of this very important relationship with Iran.
Well, this is a new level of dysfunction, and it is kind of taking a different form. I mean, I think that what unites the decision to invite Benjamin Netanyahu without even alerting the president and this letter to the Ayatollah from 47 senators is a complete lack of belief in the legitimacy of President Obama by Republican House members and senators. They are acting as if he is not the executive, and thus they are taking his trying to essentially usurp his traditional role in speaking to foreign leaders. You know, that just speaks to how bad things have become, that Republicans are acting as if the President Obama doesn't exist by inviting Netanyahu to come here over his objections and speaking to the Ayatollah independently. We've never seen anything like this. And, of course, the consequences, you know, may be to undermine the negotiations with Iran. And I just hope that, you know, all of my friends on the Republican side are honest about what will happen if we can't reach a negotiated settlement over Iran's nuclear program. Virtually the only option we will have left is a military option. We will have to bomb Iran, and they then will retaliate either against the United States, Israel, or other allies in the region. This is a pretty dangerous part of the world to begin with, having another war erupt in a country that, by the way, is three times the size of Iraq, would be potentially catastrophic.
Talking about dangerous parts of the world, I mentioned your meeting in Connecticut with Ukrainian leaders here with John McCain. You were talking about next steps there. What do you think should be the next step for the U.S. and allies in Europe in regards to the situation in Ukraine and Russia?
Well, you know, John McCain and I held a town hall on the U.S. policy towards Ukraine at the Ukrainian National Home in Hartford, and we had, the 300-plus people who were spilling out the doors. Because we have such a huge and active and passionate Ukrainian-American community in Connecticut, it's one of the reasons that I care very deeply about this. John and I have usually been in different, have over the course of the last year and a half been in different places. He has consistently believed that we should arm the Ukrainians, the Ukrainian army to fight the Russians. I really felt like we needed to give sanctions the chance to work before we decided to provide direct arms, potentially lethal arms, to the Ukrainian army. I think Putin has shown pretty clearly at this point that he is immune to these sanctions, no matter how devastating they've been to the economy. I think we've got to increase the cost that he and his country are paying in order to get him to change his mind. Thus, I am reluctantly supportive of giving lethal assistance to the Ukrainian army. I hope that the president decides to do that. We've passed legislation giving him the power to do it. And before Putin is successful in essentially connecting the territory he controls in eastern Ukraine with Crimea, establishing an autonomous stretch of territory from Russia all the way down to the Crimean Peninsula, I think we've got to change the dynamic on the battlefield.
Chris Murphy represents Connecticut in the U.S. Senate. We spoke with him yesterday afternoon. When we come back from our break, Max Creek has been playing the jam band circuit for decades, and they're about to celebrate their 44th anniversary as a band. They may be older than Chris Murphy. They'll join us in our Studio 3 to share some of the music that's kept them together for nearly 4.5 decades. That's next on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Max Creek.
So you're trying. Touching my eyes and you're moving my stars. Well, hey, it's no problem. Running for answers and asking for miles. Well, I think I found them. Situation is just as you please. I could tell you what's happening. Seems like
can you tell?
That's Max Creek performing the song Emotional Railroad live for us here in our Studio 3 on Where We Live. They're a band that's made up of members Scott Morosky on guitar, Mark Mercier on keyboard, John Ryder playing bass, Bill Carbone and Jay Stanley playing percussion. This year, Max Creek is celebrating their 44th anniversary as a band, and I'm just thrilled to have them here today to share some of the music that has brought them together for nearly four and a half decades. Max Creek, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, it's really exciting to have you guys here, and we're going to be talking a lot about the history of the band over the course of the next segment of the show. But first, Scott, that's one of your songs. Tell me about the song we just heard.
Actually, we were in the car on our way home from playing a weekend in Rochester, New York, and I wrote the song in the car on the way home, scribbled it down in notes or whatever, and then I got home and recorded the whole thing.
Is that how it happens a lot? You're on the road a lot, you're driving in between gigs, and just things come to you?
Things come to me in the car, actually, a lot. I actually, when I'm looking for lyrics or melodies or whatever, I'll take and make a recording of the rhythm track or whatever and bring it out in the car with me so that I can, when I'm driving around, I can sing along with it and come up with stuff. But yeah, absolutely.
I've got to ask you guys, and I'm going to talk to Scott, Mark, and John, three of the longest-serving members of the band here, to maybe tell me the origin story. We're talking about 1971 when the band starts, so that's a long, long time ago. Okay, so John, well, tell me the story. I mean, how'd the band start?
Actually, it was on my birthday. Dave Reed and I, who played trumpet together at Hart College of Music, were sitting in my dorm room, and we decided that there probably weren't going to be a lot of jobs available for trumpet players, so why don't we form a band? And he knew this guy, Bob Goslin, who could play drums. So I said, well, okay, I'll get a bass, and I'll play bass. And he said, I'll get a guitar, and I'll play guitar. And we also needed some kind of keyboard, so we got a Cordovox player named Kenny, who came in for a short while, and that's where it started.
Obviously, 1971, there were probably a lot of guys in college dorm rooms saying, there's not a whole lot of need for fill-in-the-blank, trumpet player or whatever, let's start a band. Did you feel like you were part of, you know, a lot of people doing the same thing, or did you feel like you had something very special with this particular group doing what you were doing?
You know, when your youth, you know, wins out, it's like, yeah, we're great. We're going to be great. We're going to get this together. And, of course, the first gig that we got together, we were playing a strip joint, you know, charts for strippers, and we were the in-between band. And we soon discovered maybe there was something else that we wanted to do besides that. So we started writing songs and practicing.
Well, what were you listening to back then? I mean, what was the music that was driving you to want to play music together?
Oh, geez. You know, it was really a rich time musically. I mean, there was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Grateful Dead, The Band, all these, you know, spectacular groups that will live on in history. Janis Joplin. It was just a tremendous time musically. So you got your influences from a whole mess of different places.
Yeah. And when did you join the band?
Oh, that Dave Reed, who was a guitar player, got appendicitis and went into the hospital. And
we're laughing. That's not funny. It's too bad for him, yes.
It is now. He lived through it, so it's okay. But they had a couple of gigs that they needed to play at, and I was John's roommate in college, and I was home on Christmas vacation up in Maine, and he called me up and said, can you come down and learn some charts, which I did. And played in East Hartford at a place called The Other Horse, which is part of the Rocking Horse. And that was my first gig. And it didn't go very well, but it was just a really interesting time, and I liked it. And they decided to keep me on after that, even after Dave came back. He got well and came back.
It was a trick anyway. Trying to get you in the band.
Just trying to get somebody in the band. Scott, how about you? When did you join?
I joined, I think, in the early 72, and then I got thrown out because at the time, the drinking age was 18, and I was 15, and we had this. We played this regular gig, the Rocking Horse, in Hartford on every Saturday night, and nobody really, we didn't really, like, even talk about my age to any of the other clubs, but because these guys were friends and, you know, whatever. So anyway, they caught me drinking beers, and they said, oh, you can't play here anymore. And so I was ousted from the band for a while, and then about six months.
Until you were 18, you couldn't play there.
Right. Yeah.
So you're out of the band a little bit because you weren't of drinking age. I mean,
and I was drinking beers during, like, I was only playing on 10 songs. I was like the lead, you know, the ringer. I'd come up and play lead on a song, and then I'd go out and drink beer.
And you'd go out and drink beer, which is probably part of the problem.
But then 6 months later, you came back, and we said you were 18, and that.
Yeah,
there we go.
You aged very quickly, you know? Right. Well, tell me about the scene back then. You've already talked about playing in a strip club. You talked about playing at clubs that don't exist anymore, certainly. I don't know, John, what was it like back then to find gigs and to start a band and try to find places to play around?
Lots of energy, and we really believed we were going to do something wonderful. And, of course, after the first year, we were amazed we were still together. Second year, after the 10th year, it was like, well, how long can this possibly last? You know?
But that's a big thing. It's that transition between a band that is together for a year or two and decides to play some music together, maybe write some songs. And then, I don't know, Mark, after 10 years, you start to think, well, this is a thing. This is part of our lives. Maybe we can do this for a much longer period of time. What was that transition like?
You know, it wasn't a transition. It was always that way. I mean, when we first joined the band, it became a very special thing, and it was a very special time. We would play the Rocking Horse, and Paul LeMay, who was head of the Peace Train Foundation, who John Ryder picked up hitchhiking when he got the idea for the Peace Train up in Massachusetts, used to come in and distribute oranges to everybody, and everyone would be dancing, and it was just a very special thing even back then. So I think the specialness kind of like continued. It was community. It was more than music. It was a whole community. You had friends. You had family. People lived. People died. You know, and it was just one of those things.
Yeah. We're talking with the band Max Creek. They've been playing in and around Connecticut and all over New England, all over the place, for more than four decades, celebrating their 44th anniversary this year. They've got a gig coming up on March 21st that we'll tell you more about at the Outer Space in Hamden. More information on our website at WNPR.org. And they're playing for us live in our Studio 3. Let's hear another song. And, John, maybe you can tell us about the song. It's called Blood Red Roses.
Once again, this was written about somebody in Rochester. We did a lot of writing because it was such a long way to Rochester. But it was a person who was very influential in getting us out of New England and moving out to Rochester. And this song I wrote about him and his unfortunate suicide. Mm. And though the song has some more uplifting parts to it, there are other parts that are, you know, definitely it was my way of getting out. Like, how could you do this? Mm. You know?
Let's hear the song. It's called Blood Red Roses. It's by the band Max Creek, and they're here in our studio. Yeah, they've been playing around in our area for many, many decades, and they're here finally in our Studio 3 playing for us live on Where We Live. Thank you. That was Max Creek performing a tune called Blood Red Roses, live in our Studio 3. When we come back from our break, they'll play some more of their music and talk about life on the road. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, we talk a lot about education on WNPR, but one voice we miss out on a lot on Where We Live, well, it's teachers. On the next Where We Live, we'll listen back to a recent evening panel discussion we hosted where we invited elementary school teachers from across the state. What's it like to teach our youngest students today? What are some of the challenges and achievements in the classroom? I hope you can join us tomorrow. Today on our program, we're talking with the jam band Max Creek. They've been around for 44 years. Members Scott Morosky, Mark Mercier, John Ryder, Bill Carbone, and Jay Stanley are here. They're joining us to share some of their music and talk a bit about these many years on the road together playing music that so many people across New England, across the Northeast, have been hearing for years. We're thrilled to have them in our studio. You guys toured a lot through the 1980s. You're not on the road as much as you used to be. Do you ever miss the bustle of being out there all the time, Scott?
I miss aspects of it. I don't miss other aspects of it, I guess.
What aspects do you miss?
I miss the camaraderie. You know, like the way it is now. I mean, we're basically on our own. You know, we either rent a couple of cars or we all take our own cars or whatever. But in the old days, we had a band car and everybody rode up together, and there was a lot of that kind of like. Yeah, you know, male bonding kind of thing that we don't do as much anymore, I guess.
What do you miss about it, John? Or do you?
Yeah, I liked playing 14 days in a row. And, you know, just a tightness that comes out of playing that together. And then, you know, we have a week off and then you're back doing it again. And you know, there were some years where we had almost 300 shows in a year. So we were – there was a couple of months that we actually out of 31 days, we were doing 25 days.
It's so interesting because there's a lot of rock and roll songs written about the grind of the road and how much it wears you down over time. But that's something, Mark, that we don't hear as much about. It's that when you play a lot together, you get really good. I mean, you get really tight and you feel like you're able to play music in a way you probably weren't before you went out on the road like that.
Exactly. Yeah, you develop that ESP thing. You know where musically everyone else is going at any particular point in time. And it's a very cool thing because particularly when you do four or five dates in a row, that fifth date, you know exactly where someone might be headed. The beauty of what we do, though, is it's different every time. We never do any song the same way twice. So consequently, when you start to explore and you hear other people explore, it gets really nice.
And that's probably another way in which people who have long been fans of the Grateful Dead have connected with your music. It's the idea that the two Grateful Dead shows were never the same, ever, twice. And you've tried to do that throughout these years.
Yeah. I mean, we've had to, basically, because otherwise you fall over from boredom.
And then that's the thing is, in order to not be bored, you know, making it different every night is where it's at. And, you know, if you do the same, I just can't imagine doing the same songs over and over in a set pattern, and that's the show.
But it's not really deliberate on our part. It's just something that happens. I mean,
the other thing too is that with jam bands, a typical rock band will play a different city every night and get a different group of people every night. Whereas jam bands, there's a scene that follows you every night, and so they're going to be, you know, they pay attention and they'll know like, oh, would they repeat it? They played this song last night, and you know, like 300 miles away, but I was there, you know, so. Being a jam band, I think you get people that come to every show, and so you want to make it something special for them.
Well, who is your crowd now, and how's that crowd changed over the years?
Oh, boy.
You just keep getting younger and younger and younger.
I suppose that's good, right? Well, I mean, really, is it a younger crowd? I mean, is it people who have been following you for 40 years, or is it people who weren't born?
Yes, both. I mean, basically, we have people who are in their 60s who have been around for all 44 years. And we have people who are 18 years old who come to shows and come to festivals.
Whose grandparents used to follow us.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, literally, I mean, sometimes that can happen.
Well, a lot of people have come up to me over the years and said, oh, well, my brother brought me to this show when I was 10 years old, or my father and mother brought me to Camp Creek and different this festival, that one, and when I was 5. And now they're 25, so you know they're just passing it on to generations.
And that must feel good in a way, right? I mean, you're exposing new people to music all the time, right?
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. And one of the nice things is when someone who has been away from the scene, you know, had 2 or 3 kids and a job in the insurance office, and then all of a sudden they show up at a show, and it's like they're coming home. Really, they show up. They're so happy that we're still doing it.
So we read this that you used to play regularly at the Living Room in Providence. Is this true that when you went on tour, the famous jam band Fish would actually fill in for you until you guys returned? Is this a true story?
Yep.
Really?
They may have some.
They may have some.
Oh yeah, I guess that did happen once. That did happen once.
Oh really?
We were gone for a few weeks, and they came in and took our place.
They actually took your place for a while. Do you have a standing relationship with them or some of the other jam bands that are out there playing to groups of people all over the country?
They're buddies of ours.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Scott plays in Mike Gordon's side project band, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the things about this whole idea of jam bands is there is this scene, and it is a sort of a strange scene, and it's different than the regular rock and roll scene. I mean, how do you see it as a different thing? Is it just a different group of people who go out and see jam bands all over the place? Is it a different audience?
I think they're more musically particular. Like Scott said, they pay attention. They pay attention to the music. They pay attention to how one thing is different from another. They're also community-oriented. I mean, if you go online and you go on Facebook, you see these people talk to each other all the time. You're going to the next show. You know, someone may be in Rochester, someone may be in Providence, and they'll meet up at a show. And that's part of the enjoyment of the whole situation. I think jam bands really enjoy that kind of an audience.
Could you talk, Scott, more about that community aspect? Because I think that's a big part of what you guys are trying to do. You build a community, trying to put people together, and that's something that's maybe a little bit more, it's longer lasting than just being guys who, you know, play in a bar every now and again.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that also goes back to the traveling from show to show to show to show. And summer tour, people get together. They haven't seen each other since the last tour. And there's that whole community spirit there. And I think social networking has enabled that to be even more so, where people can remain connected while the tour's not happening. And so I think even more so today, it's more of the global community extends to the jam band community, I would say.
Do you guys think that there are as many places to play music and to hear music today in our area as there were back when you guys started back in the early and mid 70s?
Boy, I mean there are probably as many places to play. They're not quite as renowned. I mean, you have each town has its own place where bands play and get together. It's hard to say because we really actually don't play Connecticut quite that often. We've been down in Rhode Island, up in New York, up in Upper New England. But the way I see it, there are quite a few places to play. I don't think there are as many places where there's a lot of originality going on as much.
Well, anymore. I guess another way to ask it is, because you play all over the region, are there some things that Connecticut's music scene, do you think, could learn from some of the other places you go, whether you're in upstate New York or elsewhere in New England? You know, are there some things that Connecticut could be doing better, do you think?
Oh, that's a very loaded question.
I'm all about the loaded questions.
If they're in Rochester, always go to the bar and get 2 drinks. People in every area are different. You know, you go down south and they're one thing. Everyone will turn out at any show down south. Mother, father, grandmother, they all turn out, you know, just because there's a show going on. Connecticut's not quite that way. You got to work a little harder to convince people that they should be going to the show.
Plus, I think entertainment-wise, home entertainment is such a big deal now. And with, you know, they have 50-inch screens and it's high definition or whatever. It's like, I was talking with somebody about going to baseball games, and they said, well, why go to the game? You can see it so much better right on your TV at home. And so I think in order to get people out and get them into the clubs, you really have to be good. Because people are attached to their entertainment systems, and they're going to stay home unless you give them a really good reason. So I think that aspect of the business has changed.
Let's hear one more song from the band Max Creek, and they're here live in our Studio 3, and the band is Scott Morosky, who's a guitarist and singer, and Mark Mercier, who's plays keyboards and sings for the band. John Ryder plays bass, Bill Carbone plays percussion, and Jamie L. Stanley plays percussion as well. Maybe you can tell us about the song Fire and Brimstone before we hear it.
Basically, I'm a full-time church organist, and I play out in Simsbury at one of the congregational churches.
I came to visit your church not so terribly long ago.
I had a nice
day out there, yeah. And got to talk to some folks in that.
Yeah,
in that
and the whole gospel aspect, gospel music, has always interested me, and I decided to write a gospel tune with kind of a religious flavor, but also a social flavor to the whole situation. But it's kind of a New Orleans beat, which I also like. So.
Well, the song's Fire and Brimstone, and the band is Max Creek. They're celebrating their 44th anniversary, and we're pleased to have them here in our Studio 3 here on Where We Live.
You know that he don't know it, but it's hot as hell down there. Well, he just sitting there and wondering as he runs out of time, just where in hell he's going at the end of the line. I've been evil, a sinner too. I know that I ain't been good, but I'm just as bad as you. Just take a good look around you, yeah. You can tell that one man's heaven is another. Your life away. I'm gonna lay me down. I'm gonna lay me down. I'm gonna lay me down, dear Lord, lay me down by the river to stay with you. And the devil, he wanna get you, my friend, unless you change your way. So get down by the river and get ready for judgment day. Lord, the fires of hell are gonna steal your soul away. Stay with you.
lay me down. I'm gonna lay me down. I'm gonna lay me down here, Lord. Lay me down by the river to stay with you. I'm gonna lay me
Max Creek, live on Where We Live. Max Creek is Scott Murawski and Mark Mercier, John Ryder, Bill Carbone, J. Morrell Stanley. They're celebrating their 44th anniversary. They've got a gig coming up that we'll have on our website, WNPR.org. It's happening March 21st in the outer space in Hamden, happening at 7 o'clock that night. It's a Saturday night. So for the big anniversary, 44, it's not one of those, you know, it's a round number, but it's not one of those big landmark numbers, but you're still going to be celebrating. It's a pretty good milestone. How are you going to be celebrating?
Cake.
You have a special show planned or anything?
Well, yeah, we've got a where is that show in
Providence? Met. Yeah,
Providence
at the Met, of Rhode
yeah,
Island.
It's an anniversary show. Although it's like every one of them after 40 is a big one. You know, it's like my mother who was 90. You know, we celebrate the 90th, with 91st, and 92nd. You know, we're.
Yeah, it's
each
funny how that works.
A big one.
When you're 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, all those birthdays are really important. Then, you know, it doesn't matter so much for a while. But again, once you get up over 40, I can imagine. So, yeah, closing in. I mean, it's going to be a 50-year anniversary not too long from now. Do you have a plan for how long Max Creek's going to stay together?
We've never had a plan for that at all.
It sounds like you've been doing pretty well without having a plan, right? I mean, does that sound about right, Scott?
Yeah, it actually works better that way. We try to plan things. Things get all messed up. It's like, all right.
Well, I have to say, it's been a great pleasure to have you guys playing in here. We've been wanting to have you in for quite some time because you've been a big part of the music scene here in Connecticut and the Northeast for so many years, and we're just thrilled to have you here playing some music and talking with us here in Where We Live. Best of luck to you. Best of luck on another 44 years. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf. WNPR's digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Our interns are Julia Pastel and Sydney Lauro. You can continue this conversation on our website, WNPR.org. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.